execute. And it's also the understanding of what it means to care for people and care for the mission along the way. So attitude and aptitude are kind of the two check marks I'm looking at, Mitch, when I'm thinking about those things. I'm not perfect when I make those judgments, but working towards it, working to get there.
Ryan, you've had your hand up a while. You're muted.
There we go. I'm the first one who's been muted. So there you go. I get the award for the day. I think I got the award yesterday. I think the conversation is an excellent conversation. I think when, as a CIO, our jobs are 25% social worker, psychologist, and HR, very much what you said, John, in the context of one of your slides, right? And then we figure out what we do with the other 75% of our time. As somebody who just recently left an organization, my staff went through withdrawal and fear because they felt that the culture of the organization was built around me. And now they were going to have to go through transition and transformation with new leadership style. And whether or not the next leader coming in will be better than me in context of overall people skills versus, you know, whether or not there's going to be, you know, sort of that we miss Brian type of syndrome. My goal, very similar to yours, has been to sort of, you know, build a culture of family, of camaraderie, of support amongst a staff of 200 people, which is not easy because, quite frankly, I don't want to put 200 of my own family in the same room with me, but I had 200 of these people together with in the same room or close to it, and it worked out very well. The other point I just want to make is that, and I agree with this concept that has been sort of, you know, permeating around this, IT people are horrible managers, especially legacy IT people. They don't want to manage people. They just want to keep their head down, do their work, and let everyone else, you know, go. And if they are a manager, they're not perceived as being the best manager to the people that they lead. So investing in that type of level of management is extremely important. And I saw, I think it was Tina who said, you know, she sends all her new managers to the EDUCOURSE Management Center. That's important stuff. I think we have to do a better job at investing in our managers, especially the younger set that are coming in, because the younger people who are coming in are actually much more social. They do have more social skills, but they also don't have they come in with a bit of an attitude like, yeah, I know how to do this. I can handle this. And they don't want to embrace some sort of basic management principles that could help them succeed and go forward. Another thought that I just want to offer is one of the things that we did to think about our workforce going forward is we had a process where we did staff evaluations every year. And I held a lot of responsibility and accountability to my managers to get those done. There is no excuse not to tell someone what they're doing well and what they're doing and what they're doing wrong and give them a plan to improve. And you should not be waiting years to do that. You should be doing this on a regular cycle. But I forced my managers to build into their evaluations every year a professional development plan. Something in the plan, in their evaluation that says over the next year, I would like to see you either do management courses. I'd like to see you take additional training classes outside of your comfort zone. I want you to expand your, expand your horizons. I want you to pick an area within this organization that you don't know anything about. And I want you to learn about it. All right. Even if it means me saying, go work there for 3 days or 5 days. So you can learn more about what your colleagues do. That was the professional understanding and development. I wanted to build a broader understanding of most people. So anything that you can do in these areas, I think are enormous opportunities for growth, retention. And, you know, the other piece of this is that, and this is the final word I'll offer on this. And as again, building on my recent retirement from the university, is make sure that what you all have a core team. You have a senior team that you lean heavily on a day-to-day basis that you know that if you go on vacation, they're there to keep the place and the lights on. Make sure they are as much involved in what you're doing from an HR, from a culture, from a development perspective as you are. Don't take this upon yourself because when you do transition, all right, you want that culture to continue. And the only way to continue is if you know that the team below you embraces those principles as well. So those are just some of my words of wisdom.
John Barton, you've got your hand up as well. Are you there, John?
He's on mute. Johnny on mute.
My turn. you had a very successful, some would say, very successful VREF, right, in the big and I'm curious how that's affected long-term staffing levels for you and kind of what service implications it's had and how you've been dealing with that.
Yeah, that actually was a concern. So when this all came forward in early 2020, the president asked me for worst case scenario and I gave him 7 slides. And on one slide, I said, Todd, the worst case scenario is that, my team recognizes that they can get paid a lot more than what they're getting paid here.
Sure.
And that this kind of, you know, it goes more broadly. We have attracted individuals from across the campus. So Kent State was highly decentralized. We're still decentralized, but was highly decentralized. A lot of what you've heard me talk about in terms of our mind shift about caring and belonging and still doing great work and innovating has attracted some of those individuals in. So the 33% down is not where it is any longer. And we are able to rehire, but we're rehiring with this thought. We're raising our leaders and we're bringing people in more at the junior level versus the mid-level because the mid-level's gone immediately, right? You know, we may hire them in at 80, 90, 100,000 and they turn around literally in months and they're 150 or more. So we're taking a strategy of any of that and working it that way. So our service levels, we've found through necessity, not just dialogue anymore, like, hey, we should automate that. Hey, we should become more scalable. Hey, we should, necessity actually demonstrated ways or the right things to do to enhance that. And we've reduced our portfolio too, John. We had a fairly bloated portfolio, you know, 4 screwdrivers to screw in the same screw sort of thing. So we've identified how to get to at least 2 and in some cases 1. So that's helped. All of those factors have helped us stay on a fairly appropriate and reasonable service level. Yeah. So
thanks, John.
Yeah.
Did you, in that initial pitch to downsize your institution, lose people that you didn't want to lose, John?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. That's going to happen, though, right? I think if we take the perspective that we're really invested in the person and they're really good and we want to keep them, but the best thing for them is to move, I'm going to continue to experience that over time. Yeah. We've definitely lost really good people. But those people we still stay in touch with and they're progressing wonderfully in their new locations. So good for them, I guess, is the approach that I'm taking. And this is an interesting point because there were a lot of sad faces like, oh my goodness, we just lost so-and-so. And I said, did we lose so-and-so or did so-and-so just gain an opportunity for themselves? And now somebody else in our division has an opportunity to gain something else. Right. So, but for the longest time, we were crying in our cereal, you know, it was kind of like, let's just change the perspective here. Good for them. And now somebody else gets an opportunity to have something good happen here for them or something different happen for them here.
Just as something we have done is we have fairly large hiring teams from across the campus, including faculty now when we bring in people in all of our divisions so they all get to know each other. But another thing that we do is the people who sat on the hiring committee, if we were able to hire someone, are also a resource to that person for a year to help them sort of assimilate, be part of the group. And then at the end of the year, we do how that person did is on their review. And that allowed us to stay in contact, allowed us to say, how are you driving any problems? Oh, John helped me, or Ellen helped me, or so-and-so did this. And everybody's involved, and that person starts feeling part of a team, even if they're remote. Because that's another response. How do we maintain that connection with the person? How do we build a larger community for that person to reach out to in case something goes wrong? And we sort of emphasize that in our hiring letter. And our letter basically states that here's these people, we think you're the best employee, that, and we want you here. These people are assigned to you. They will go ahead and help you come to Dartmouth, be part of Dartmouth. And that's made a difference in how we approach it. Plus the idea that they get reviewed at the end as to how well that person did.
No, it's great.
It's more of a process, but it is something that changed and allowed us to assimilate remote people much more into the organization.
I like that, Mitch. I'm going to steal that.
Welcome to it. It's actually the first time you do it, it'll surprise people. You want us to do what? And you're going to judge us on that person's success? Well, if you think hiring is the most important thing we do, and we happen to do it really well and you're part of it, it's going to look really good on your review.
Yeah, we haven't implemented that as of yet, but I like that a lot.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up this discussion? One thing that it points to from the discussion yesterday, John Barden led us on, and that John has led us on this morning, is that we need to have some time to talk about what does an IT organization for higher ed look like in the next 5 to 10 years. I think that's going to be an interesting conversation. You know, we talked just now about how some people, you know, don't want to manage. Do they have a place in the IT organization in the future? They're really technically savvy and they're good at what they do, but they don't want to manage. Are we going to say, well, you got to be prepared to do some management or you're out? You know, those are discussion questions too that we need to.
I don't think that's true. There is a place. I mean,
yeah.
I know that half of my staff were on the spectrum, especially the technical ones of some level of Asperger's, and their expertise is not management.
Right.
When they're deep in the tech, whether it's information or data, you want them there. They will go places nobody else will go, and they'll stay there where no one wants to be. And you have to have a path for development for them and their careers and also compensation. They're compensated for doing a job that very few people can do. And if you're not willing to have, I'd say, two paths, you have a management path. I have people, at least four right now, that make much more than their managers because I have new managers. And I don't see a problem with that. And I think in the future, really deep tech people are going to be important because the amount of expertise you have to put into people these days to be really almost, what I'd say, experts in their field is very specific and takes time to develop. And it's not management skills, it's tech skills that you want sometimes.
And just to that point, then, Mike, I know we want to get to Vince. To what Mitch is talking about, we actually did work with HR to create a different lane for those individuals so that we could recognize them as progressing as leaders, because in the past you had to have people you managed. And so we've modified that in our org or in our division.
Mitch brings up a point that reminds me of some years ago. I was brought into an academic leadership role and they said, you know, you've got professors that make more money than you do as a dean. Does that bother you? And I said, heck no. If I'm willing to accept this salary for the position and I'm learning, you know, what does their salary have to do with mine? And,
well, I mean, chief information security officer is, you know, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
Right. Well, thank you again, John. And we'll pass those slides around to everyone. Haven't seen anybody in a while that is trying to get in. So I think we're at the level we're going to be. Vince, would you like to kick us off on the next one and share slides?
Yeah, I got slides to share. And actually, what I'm going to talk about is rhyming wonderfully with this entire conversation. And so, in fact, it's really just another spin on it, and mainly as a result of our cloud planning. So let me bring this up, and I'll set a little context here. Hopefully, all y'all can see that, to borrow a Kentucky phrase. Here at UC San Diego, we're coming around the end of our movement of all of our legacy software, enterprise and otherwise, including our learning management system, from on-premise, you know, systems in our data center to nearly all of the software service cloud. And we're kind of near the end of it. We'll call it the SIS transaction core. We've already done a lot of work around the outsides of the SIS system, but the core registration core is what we're now, our last bit we're looking for. But along the way, we've discovered that, cloud really brings agility. There's no question about that. And, you don't have to slog around things in a data center in order to make some pretty drastic changes or maneuvers. And in software as a service, you're relieved of that work, although you have to deal now with different forms of software delivery in software as a service market, especially the continuous delivery paradigm. Because continuous delivery means continuous testing as well. And so many of the SaaS vendors have a cadence for which they make changes and then a period of time for us to absorb them. And then an infrastructure as a service, tremendous ability to, you know, terraform quickly. And so that means lots of agility, but it also means a lot of organizational adroitness. We'll go to the next slide here and talk a little bit about some things that I've been reading. And it's a dangerous thing when I read. So my wife always reminds me, don't read. It's just pretty dangerous to everybody. But two books that just caught my eye, and I'm right in the middle of them right now. One of them is The MVP Machine, and it's beyond Moneyball. It's called Better Ball, and it's analytics and advanced technologies for turning mediocre talent into MVP talent. And it's actually being led by some players themselves who do things like very high-speed photography to analyze the spin rate of the ball upon exit of the fingers, the position of the fingers, and movement of the wrist, in order to, in a very quick feedback cycle, begin to alter and change and bring new pitches in, et cetera, et cetera. I thought that was very fascinating. And the reason baseball is starting to push towards better ball is everybody's doing money ball, so there's no more advantage for anybody. So the process of selecting talent by looking at numbers and piecing together collections of talent to produce aggregate numbers, everybody's doing that. And the better ball is now driving talent development. The second one is Work Without Jobs. It's a book that talks about deconstruction of jobs. So forget the job description, deconstruct the activities within the jobs, and then reallocate those activities much more flexibly and appropriately given the unique talents, contributions, and desires of the workforce. And so the two of them just sort of happened to catch my eye in the last month, and so I've been piecing my way slowly through them. So that's some of the context here. Some inside money ball number here for us at our university and my IT staff. I'll start in the upper left. The turnover rate for my IT staff bifurcates now, and it has to do with our pension system in California, which has undergone subsequent reform over the last 7, 8, 9 years now. To the point where we don't really have a pension anymore. We have a very modest glorified 401k. And so for new workers coming in, that's pretty apparent to them. There's absolutely no reason to stay at UC in the UC system for a pension. And we're seeing that in our turnover rates. So under 5 years, a higher turnover rate, nearly 20% now are turning over. on us at that level. And then 5 to 10, where the real cutoff is about 10 years, slightly lower rate. And we have two bands, 10 to 20 years, 20 to 30 years. I call this our pensioneers. These are people who are never going to leave because the pension is so rich, they're going to stay until they retire, and then they'll have a very nice pension for their retirement. And then we have, while the number is large there, we have a very small number of employees in that category, but they're starting to retire off. You know, certainly we've seen the great resignation and the effect of COVID happen. So what it turns into is we have two turnover rates, essentially. Anybody new? And that 16% is probably the low number. I think it's going to hover more closer to 20% as each year goes by. And then the over five is going to be in this more natural 6 to 9% range that higher ed typically sees. Within my unit, we've also, since I've gotten here, acquired lots of other distributed IT units. And so we're about as centralized as we ought to be. And so now I'd call us, you know, I won't say heavy central, but for an institution like ours, appropriately centralized. We have distributed IT in distributed units, largely doing desktop support, last mile research support. And that's appropriate. But over the years, we've merged in a bunch of folks from those units. We actually have a fairly low turnover rate for those merged units, which is kind of fascinating, largely because they're all pensioners, but I think largely because the ones that stuck with us really liked coming into the larger unit and having a bigger set of opportunities for them. This sets a context for what we need to do with cloud and our cloud architectures and our agility. And over the last few years, I've been building up our organizational sort of approach to say, we're going to onboard people continuously, and we are going to plan their exits to where they're going to go in life next. So we are a minor league baseball team developing talent to where they will go next to bigger and better things. We do not have the economic horsepower to command the retention of that talent. But we have all sorts of interesting opportunities and attractiveness for that crowd coming in, especially with broad exposure to the type of cloud technologies and new techniques we're bringing to bear. In fact, we designed our facilities with that sort of collaboration in mind, and COVID has now caused us to completely unwind the facilities as 80% of my unit doesn't want to be in the facility. They're all working remotely, and we're going to continue to do that by and large, although hybrid, but think of it as 80% of the time employees will be working out of their home office. And that's actually been working really well for us, and it's enabled us to recruit out of state very, very well. And so we're going to continue with that strategy. This now leads to our team philosophy and being a Lean Six Sigma place. Flow is really, you know, Lean Six Sigma is not about waste removal, nor is lean. That's really one of the techniques. So what lean is really about is about increasing flow, which is you need to get the goods needed, be they information goods or physical goods, through the process that makes it to the point of need at the time of the point of need. And that's what flow is all about. If you think about a manufacturing line, cars coming off an assembly line, you got to get the raw materials into the assembly line, put it on the car at exactly the right time in the assembly line when it's needed there, and then the car to market at the point that demand is going to take it up. And in a way, that top arc is our service flow. That's what we do. We, you know, we have services we offer. We're trying to figure out what people are going to need at some point in the future, and we're trying to arrange our service so that it can be delivered at that point in time. And typically we're optimizing price or cost of that service. And so that occupies certainly a lot of our CIO time. There are two, we look at from our team philosophy, two big contributors to that flow, that service flow. And the first one on the left is the knowledge flow. How quickly can people in our unit absorb the knowledge needed to deal with the new technology in the cloud and the continually evolving technology in the cloud? Just when you establish an architectural approach in the cloud, new tools come up that say, hey, this is going to be an advantage if we switch, which means we have to have our knowledge flows into staff timed well. Knowledge flows come in two ways or three or four ways, but two I'll list here are, you know, reading, self-study, and then work assignment or work activity or team activity of some sort. And there, you know, the purpose of our knowledge flow, sort of planning is to make sure we can get more productivity out of our knowledge workers, meaning more throughput, more things done in the same amount of time. The last flow we've discovered is actually really important, and we call it shop floor redesign flow. The concept of a lean, you go to the shop floor, you look at how the assembly is working, you say, okay, we got to change the process here, change the mechanics of the floor. And we've done that now probably 20 times in the last 5 years. We've done what we call shop floor redesigns, which means how people work, who they report to, and who they interact with changes. Classic organizational redesign. And the thing we're usually optimizing is the budget, meaning we have limited budgets. We have to figure out how to redesign our shop floor to reduce the level of budget that we have. And we've done a number of these shop floor redesigns, which then leads to, boy, oh boy, I really have to have a tight connection to HR. We got to lead this because they're not going to lead us through this, but we need to exercise the HR machinery in order to do this in time. So our shop floor redesign flow has to hit at the point before we're starting to adjust our service flow and get our services out there. And this requires, as you can tell, a lot of interesting, exquisite, long arc coordination as you think about the whole development process across the board. And it sort of devolves down to some simple concepts, and I'll give you one here. We call it simple passion, mission, alignment. Our job is to connect staff passion to our mission. That's kind of it. And if we can do a really good job of that, then productivity tends to soar. And what I have to do in my unit is make sure there's no or few impediments to that flow of knowledge, meaning get the employee positioned in the organization to absorb the knowledge and do the work they do and produce. One big impediment in IT tend to be silos and managers who want to protect their people and prevent people from moving over. The team philosophy we've put in place in order to achieve this has been, my senior managers are not owners of people like people are cattle. They are player developers. They have to develop their team members to improve them and get them on to where they think they need to go as a player. So we have, this is one example, and we got many. Dali Polichar and Jonathan, Dali is an SMT, Jonathan Whitman's a layer below, but working under Kevin Chow in our business area. They suddenly discovered that each had a player on their team that wanted to play on the other team. And so they got together and said, why don't we just switch? And they did, and sure enough, boom, productivity doubles from both of those players. And so the theoretical question, and I had to point this to one of my direct reports, who agreed with me that, yeah, there's probably, and research kind of shows there's a 5-to-1 swing in productivity between individuals and teams. One team can be 5 times more productive, which means more units of output in a given period of time than another. I said, well, if you believe that, then you have to believe that if your team is average in its knowledge productivity, then you can at least double that, which means you can do the same amount of work with half your team. And my senior manager was like, I don't think that's possible. We got some noise chatter coming in here.
Yeah, somebody.
Hello.
That's M. McGuffrey, whoever he is.
There we go.
Thank you.
My thanks.
I apologize.
Yeah.
No worries.
And he looked at me and said, I don't think that's possible. I said, well, you can't believe that there's a productivity swing, but it doesn't apply to you, right? So those are incongruent beliefs, right? So the question is how much productivity gain or absorption can your unit do by better aligning passion with mission? And, you know, it's a very fascinating phrase that DePaul had, driven by St. Vincent de Paul, the saint and priest that was based on its founding. Love is inventive to infinity, or I say passion is inventive to infinity. And so I don't know if there's a true upper bound on the productivity, as I have certainly seen in my professional life, both within higher ed and especially outside of higher ed, frequently very small passionate teams just really outperforming teams that are struggling with either the managerial alignment or the employee alignment. Here's another example where we just did a kind of a retrospective on our call center service desk. And the middle chart is the interesting one because they've more than doubled their output. And I haven't given them a lick of budget. In fact, I've been hammering them on their budget. So I called Brett. I said, Brett, you're lying to me. There's no way you could have done this. He said, well, let me explain how we did it. I said, what'd you do? He said, I took people from my call center and my field support team. I removed them and I put them on my ServiceNow team. And I had them build all the automation we need to automate as many tasks as possible using ServiceNow. So we're not doing it anymore. And that's a perfect example of a shop floor redesign in which you took resources from one element of the manufacturing process and put it to another element, the front element, and then focused it on automation. And that's one example of that. Here's another one. This is what Kevin Chow has done. And we've been planning this for a while. We've had to go through a couple of minor shop floor changes in order to get ready for the bigger one, which we've now executed. Going to the cloud means you're no longer writing software to the degree that you used to. What you are doing is you're doing data integration and data science-y type things more so, and especially data integration to and from systems. We typically had data integration distributed across IT, kind of in a Rembrandt Studio model, where that one person who was doing it was the artiste responsible for soup to nuts, every aspect of the integration. We then moved that to redirect all those resources under a manager who's actually, it's one of those cases where his architectural skills exceed his managerial skills, but his managerial skills are good with engineering type people, right? So it's a nuance on can all my engineers become managers? And I think that's a shade of gray answer. It's not a binary. And we moved him into this where he's taken off like a rocket. And they've been busy automating not just integration, but continuous testing. Every time we get updates from Oracle Financial Cloud, we have to test. That's all automated with testing and automation and upon approval, automatic submission and release to production. They've been doing this on our integrations. Any integration code that we write gets automatic security scan. That's all automated. The push to production is automated. The recordings to governance and the feedback from that is now getting all automated. And so they're essentially redesigning the shop floor. Along the way, we've probably done two or three reorganizations working with HR, along with a long arc of staff training in our new integration stack that started probably 3 or 4 years ago and had a 1.5 year arc of pushing of training and then another 8-9 months of adoption pushing. And now it's starting to hum. And in fact, the level of tickets in our service desk related to integration has dropped to practically none. Since we've centralized and modernized and automated and hardened all of that. And so this concept of decomposing the task of the worker to now reallocate it out to different collections of workers and typically at lower price points rather than higher price points away from more Rembrandt Studios to more sort of manufacturing floor. While this sounds sort of depressing to the Rembrandt out there, to the young IT worker, this actually sounds pretty hip because they're using the latest cloud tools and they're doing some cool things in NiFi, Airflow and all that stuff. And then if they want to move on, they can move on in our organization. We'll help them move on elsewhere in life, depending on where they want to go next. So this has been sort of a multi-year process, but now pretty well established. A lot of benefits for us on the streamlining the software engineering, which is, we think is about probably halfway done. We got, you know, maybe 2/3 done. We got another 1/3 and a half to go, but we've had, you know, big set time savings, of a few FTE. We've had a big reduction of incidents post go live, big reduction in redeployments, and then time to complete integrations has just dropped significantly. So we're able to push more integrations faster through the pipeline. So now this is starting, this thinking is going to start hitting our desktop support pieces. In fact, we just had a person who got consolidated into us who saw that our vision for the shop floor was going to look away, was going to move from Rembrandt Studio to here. They said, you know, I'm going to go back to my department computing because that way I could be Rembrandt. I don't have to be on your machine factory floor. And we're like, well, it's coming for you too at some point. So that's fine. Proceed. This is just a list of some of the shop floor changes we do. I would say at any given point in time, we have two or three in flight. And so we expect our shop floor changes to be somewhat continuous. And I guess in any given 9 month or 6 month period, there'll be one or two in flight as we'll constantly redesign our shop floor seeking better optimums. But fortunately, we have a culture and a staff appreciation that they, it's almost always viewed as opportunity for the staff, ways of doing more of what they do. And then finally, this is actually an old thought that I've been carrying around for a while now, but it's, you know, if the CEO or the president or whatever wants to get an answer to a technology problem along a certain cost-benefit spectrum, you can go to the market and achieve from the market different solutions that have a sort of an average cost. And that's great. And you could replace all of us as CIOs and many of our people with what I'll call general market RFP concepts. And let's just go to market for everything we need and see what it gives and then get it and then move on. I think our role as CIOs are to beat the odds of the average solution, to find a superior solution. That superior solution, I believe, is one thing that gets you there, and that's team IQ. That team IQ around how they can coordinate and work together well and quickly. We have a concept we call hive mind, meaning how do I get point-to-point information using our collaboration tools like Teams from anybody who needs it to anybody who has it without needing to go up and down chains. So we do a lot of hive mind type stuff, a very impromptu, very quick, very rapid iteration and exchange of information freely across boundaries and levels. And we're continuing to push that. But the other piece of the team IQ is to understand the lay of the land inside the organization and exploit unique features of the lay of the land that open up better possibilities than otherwise the market would know about. And again, that's team IQ. And so we're kind of, you know, focused on how do we continue to develop superior solutions. And we've been kind of we've been doing this in a planful way, but also, because we know that the cloud technology gives us a lot of agility that we can really tap into. And for example, we're in our HANA environment, we can Terraform with new CPUs and memory in a weekend. I mean, even probably faster if we wish, but there's no impediment in terms of delivery and time frame of hardware and data center setup. And so we're contemplating some new terraforming in our analytics platform in order to eke out even more performance out of it at lower costs. And then lastly, just a comment. I think if staff realize they're in the right place at the right time, they tend to have more confidence and stability, and that helps them navigate turbulence. I'm going to stop there. Turn it over to the group.
So Vince, you talk a lot about internally in IT, but how do you measure the success of your organization based on client perception?
Well, I mean, client perception is always there, and we have, you know, all sorts of measures in some regard on that being in UC here. The key one for me is, okay, the people who fire me, basically, what they need to see is delivery of what is needed within and exceeding the budget, as well as service levels. And so we do a rather extensive measurement of service levels, both in my unit and through another unit on campus that does that pretty broadly across campus. So we monitor those numbers carefully. But the executive, you know, my chancellor and my immediate boss, Pierre Ouye, examine our success in terms of hitting real critical timeframes, having high satisfaction levels, and then doing so within a conservant budget. Classics, the very classics. And that's going to vary from institution to institution. And, you know, we've got a robust governance process. We are in UC. I call it the Garden of Eden of governance. We got a committee on every tree. So just in our data and analytics governance, I have 5 or 6 committees alone, right? And that's all designed to engage the, and if not, actually we have a distributed, analytics strategy in which leadership for development of reports, workbooks, analysis is not done in central IT, but done locally. And so we got a whole strategy and governance model around that, as well as a couple other things where we're actually trying to distribute the IT talent, not centralize it. So we got oodles of measures there, but I would say it's the classics are the customer satisfaction, but then the executive demands that placed on me and my unit by my bosses as proxies or representatives of the larger community.
Has there been anything, Vince, that surprised you in terms of acceptance of this process from other managers across the institution?
Yeah, in my unit alone, we went from COBOL mainframe data center to all wicked cloud new stuff. And so the few COBOL mainframers just stand back and say, well, I'm retiring with my pension when the COBOL dies. So I'm quite happy. And we're quite happy that they do that. So internally, no, because I think for everybody new coming in, because there's a lot of turnover there, they're like, oh my goodness gracious, fool's paradise of stuff to work on here to build out my resume. And we've had some people say, hey, I'm going to come. I want to master service now. And they say, I'll likely be gone in 2 years. And they are, and they double their salary. So we call that planned exits, meaning sure, coming in, work. We have a large number of contract workers. These are workers that get full benefits, full everything, but our commitment to them is 1 year at a time with a max of 5 years. And we're likely to continue that partly because many of the workers coming in don't mind it because they're looking to improve themselves. So we're talent scouts now trying to find that. Outside of my unit, this all looks like a complete utter mystery.
I mean,
you know, if you see what I'm doing, I'm recreating essentially, not totally, but very partially what I did in consulting, in our consulting, organizations, to handle the client demand and build the uptake of the talent delivery. So when I talk about this externally, they just look at me like we're on another planet. However, we're discovering that when you adopt new, especially enterprise systems that are in the cloud, the change on the average end user is quite, you know, hard. And while we plan that change and try to get all the preparing, there's nowhere near the level of shop floor redesign, nor nowhere near the level of commitment to more, I won't say radical, but more appropriate forms of staff learning. So it always turns out that, you know, IT is never the impediment to any change. In fact, we're usually there waiting ahead, and then we're dragging the business unit through some of their changes, or they're dragging themselves, I should say, through the changes and adjusting it. So there's a big impedance mismatch between these three forms of flow in my shop and everywhere else in the kingdom. But, you know, we're forced to do it in IT because demand for our services does not decrease. Digital density does not decrease and our budget does not increase. So it's literally, you're forced to make do in those constraints.
Any other comments or thoughts?
I would say one other thing we've had is, takes a while for mid-level managers in IT to get into the concepts. So you have to kind of work with them. And especially those who are dyed-in-the-wool, classic waterfall, release to production versus DevOps or more agile data science ops stuff. And so just having the patience to give them their time to absorb, and just keeping after them, and staying in touch. So, you know, it gets a little maddening, if you're sitting in the executive office or at the senior manager level on why my team isn't getting it. But you know, we just keep pushing, we keep pushing, and then it comes around. They come around by and large.
Can we share your slides with our?
Yeah, I'll send them around.
All right. Sounds good. Any other final comments or thoughts?
Just this, Vince, I really appreciate kind of how you are wrapping process improvement or process methodologies that are structured enough that you can review the process itself to determine its success. I may reach out to you on a few of those things. We actually have a lean practice in our division, but it's not as focused on some of the internals that I see you focused on. Ours is really helping the university think differently.
Yeah.
I'd like to take some of the lessons you've learned and approaches and double down on internally too. So.
Yeah. And just a little context here so you understand, in my unit, 100% of all the IT staff has to get a lean belt, yellow belt certified to be a staff member. So that's required. My frontline managers have to be a green belt. And so we have, you know, all of our staff Lean Six Sigma certified at some level. And then we have probably about a dozen black belts roaming around in ITS. My head of this unit, Moshkan Amini, she's a black belt, and she's got a couple in her unit. And then that has extended way out into our business community where we've now had up to 3,000 or 4,000 employees in UC San Diego trained to Lean Six Sigma. My bigger challenge is, as I've told my executive peers, Lean Six Sigma lives everywhere except in the chancellor's cabinet.
Well, at the point well taken, we're actually doing that same thing. But what I see you're doing that I haven't impressed to the same degree here is that we must, in our thinking, operation, behavior, really take that methodology forward. Again, we're trying to help the university.
Yeah. And my hallmark for a test on this and why I've been harping on my executive peers is executive peers typically say things, oh my gosh, it was terrible. The problems are huge. We cannot tolerate this. Right. And that's how the executive conversation goes. Then it quickly leads to budget and impediment. A Lean Six Sigma black belt says, we've noticed a 14% drop in service levels and efficiency here, creating these problems here, here, and here. And here's where we find the point, and here's the plan to fix. Right? Our executives are incapable of that speak. They're incapable of evidence-based decision-making. And I'm going to put all of higher education largely, mostly, in this category. And I actually believe that's why our citizen taxpayers are really fed up with us. Right. Whereas, you know, my scientists here are scientists in their field and they abandon all of their science in anything related to IT systems. It goes completely to my anecdote and my pain and how millions of dollars must be spent on me to solve my pain versus a reasoned scientific understanding of the discussion. And I think it's because we've allowed our institutions to do that. Right. And so I think the way forward for universities is they have to figure how to do this in administration in order to cope with the budget pressure. And I think more importantly, the citizen stakeholder revolt, which is still going to continue on us. And, so for me, it's just continuing to cajole my executives subtly with, okay, let's get beyond the hyperbole. In the anecdote, let's get to a more dispassionate Lean Six Sigma review of this. Mm-hmm. And the good news is there's so many people down below. They're like, I think the reason this has taken off at the level of staff outside of my unit, inside my unit, is because of the lack of executive vernacular here. they're trying to cope with their world. So they go, oh my God, Lean Six Sigma gave me tools to cope with my world, at least get me marketable in case I have to leave this place because it's so crazy here. And that's why I think it's grown like crazy and why our Process Palooza has now become a nationwide conference. Started out as just an inside our university conference, and now we're looking at a few thousand attendees from across the globe. And it's all bottom up. It's kind of wild.
Any other final thoughts, any comments, questions? We're due for a break in a little bit. Let's just go ahead.
I just have one question for the crowd. Are we going too far? Have we gone too far?
Vince, I was going to say that I have a tendency to take a variable. It seems one solution, and you can apply that as long as people understand it. But I think building in a knowledge of all possible options of a way of doing things and then taking the knowledge of each one of those and applying it to any given solution allows you many opportunities of change, not just one path. But I think in the situation where you are, that it's almost like if you don't do it the way you're doing it, nobody's going to listen to you. That's what it seems to me because of the situation you're in. Again, I've said CIOs have different paths to different solutions, depends on what the organization needs. And I've watched what you've done there, and you've done amazing things while you've been there. And this idea of moving a sort of an evidence-based method so you can actually move the institution forward, even though it may not know how or want to, is a real difficult.
Or know that it needs to.
Yeah, no.
Real difficult place. What you've done there is pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, good news. I've got a lot of backing from our chancellor, who's like, "No, keep going, Vince, keep going." And then from Pierre, who is basically intellectually, we're only air gapped by about a millimeter in our thinking. We have different approaches for going at it, but the basic contours of our strategic thinking are almost identical. So I've had great executive backing from at least their quarter, which means as conflict ensues, I know where they're going to kind of land on the situation, as we kind of push the structure of the conflict forward. Cause yeah, there's been conflict, on how to measure and improve and get at management issues and shop floor issues, not just in IT, but everywhere. Thank you.
Let's take a break and we'll meet at the top of the hour. Does that sound reasonable? And this is going to be an interesting session, the next one, because Brian's going to share, retirement for many of us doesn't mean that you quit doing something. It's just that you're doing something different. And Brian is doing something different. And I think it aligns with what we began as the leadership board for CIOs in higher ed, hard to believe, 12 years ago. Time goes by fast when you're having fun. So let's take a break for about 10, 15 minutes, and we'll come right back, okay? The afternoon session.
Sure. Thank you, Mike. So as I get started with this, let me just share my screen with you guys and talk to you about Brian's life. I've retired. I retired from CUNY, and if you think I'm retired, that's a totally different discussion. But, you know, I look back on my career. I said, gee, you know, if I've done enough things in my life that I can say I've accomplished, I've hit that bucket list, it's probably a good time. And I did. I went back and I looked at my government life for 10 years. I looked at my education life for 20 years, and I said, I've done it. I've hit all the check marks. And, you know, and then the thought became sort of, what do I do next? You know, I've been the CIO for 20 years at CUNY. I did all these really senior level things in the city of New York. I got education. I got government. But what do you do next? Right. You know, in other words, what do I want to be when I grow up? And I knew there were a few things I did not want to do. I did not want to sit in that CIO role anymore. I've been woken up at night. I had to worry about all the things that you've been worrying about with staff retention and professional development and institutional research and all this other wonderful stuff and all these people. And God, I thought about the fact that I would have to do another ERP system at CUNY. And I said, I'm breaking out in sweats. I just can't do it anymore. My wife looked at me and I'm very fortunate. I joked around a few minutes ago, but my wife looked at me and she said, just retire. And I looked at her. I said, wait a second. You told me that I'm not allowed to retire until you retire first. And she says, no. She goes, I said retire. I didn't say stop working. Right. Now, that was the case. And I said, all right, well, let me start thinking about it. How much time do I have, honey? And she said, not a lot of time. So I really had to start thinking about what was I going to do when I grow up? And I came across, quite frankly, what I would say is, for me, a dream job. And why is it a dream job? Because it is an organization, it's working with an organization that supports government and education in the context of being, and it says here, we are the media research company, right? Focused exclusively on state and local government and education. So eRepublic, for those of you who never heard of eRepublic, all right, we have two national institutions. We have the Center for Digital Government, the Center for Digital Education. They both have been established for quite some time, and I'll walk you through a little bit of that. But I've been working with eRepublic and their team for probably 25 years when I was in government, because they don't sell to government and they don't sell to education. They are a thought leader. They are a collaborator. They bring the CIOs and the leadership in these areas together to really do what this group has been doing today and has been doing for the last 12 years. Talk about the real pressing issues. So it hasn't started yesterday. It's a mature company. It was started back in 1983 out of an idea that our founder, Dennis McKenna, had come up with, saying, how do we, and this is in California, but how does he leverage this thing called technology in government to make government smarter? And over the years, it's evolved into bringing education into the mix. A lot of publications, a lot of, magazines and digital publications to sort of build out what we see as the leading issues in government technology, government policy, and various different other segments of issues that affect government, emergency management, transportation issues, things like that. But what's our vision? We have always been wanting to be the trusted source for guidance, ideas, and innovations to government, because we want to make government smarter. We have had been very influential. We have our brands, the Center for Digital Government, as I mentioned, Center for Digital Education. We do an insider industry and we have an insider navigate. These are our brands that we have as an organization, and they have some pretty big notoriety. What we publish and what we do as an organization gets picked up by the Times and, other big publications, including, Fox News, CNN, Los Angeles Times. People listen to what our pieces are about, or what the topics that we bring up in these conversations. We work with organizations that go as high as governors and mayors and elected officials. We go down into the lines of business with leaders and professionals, but our sweet spot is really that dark blue area, that CIOs, CTOs, and CSOs. That's where we spend most of our focus and energy on, because we believe that where our expertise is in helping the CIOs and the CTOs navigate through the challenges and the opportunities that they have in their own organizations. What's our reach? What's our audience? Just so that everyone understands this in context. Over 300,000 active government contacts that we deal with. 28,000 unique government agencies that we're involved in. That's a pretty huge reach in the context of government. We have over 35 years of as a trusted source to government officials. The numbers here speak to itself in the context of the magnitude of our reach overall. We do, as I said, we publish, we create magazines, we create digital media on really pressing government issues. We have over 6.6 million annual unique visitors just to our GovTech site. We do monthly subscriptions and newsletters. We have social media followers, and you know, the reach is pretty huge. When you look at our audience, it's, again, it's the chief information officers, the chief technology officers, IT directors, procurement people, legal people, across governments. And when I say across governments, I mean states, counties, cities, large and small across the U.S. My position in the organization, I'm the vice president for the Center for Digital Government, and I'm also the vice president for the Center for Digital Education. In these two organizations, we have programs in which we work through government and counties and states and cities, in which we survey them. We do various different in-person. We just started our in-person events again. We do in-person events. We do virtual events, bringing them together in small groups. We don't try to boil the ocean. All right. We are more comfortable working with smaller groups of CIOs because it's a much more meaningful conversation. It's got more value coming out of the discussion. People have a voice. They want to be able to share it. And so that's been sort of the approach that we have taken in government. And, you know, we'll continue doing this. And this is just more, a little bit more information about Digital Communities Program and what we do. This is an example of some of the things that we produce. We produce profiles of government in the context of how they score within the surveys that we do. We produce pretty trending topic types of media discussions in the various different areas of technology. We are in education as well, but I'll be honest with you, you probably haven't heard of us from the Center for Digital Education, and that's because we don't have a huge footprint. And we're trying to build that footprint because we think we can have much more impact on supporting CIOs and CTOs and CISOs like within your organizations. But as an education and as an institution partner, we have over 654,000 unique visitors to our site. And we do a newsletter that you can subscribe to, which has over 25,000 people getting it on a regular basis. But overall, what is the Center of Digital Education? Just so everyone understands what we do. We're a resource for education market. We do K through 12. We do higher education. We bring thought leaders together on trending topics of policy and funding and on technology. And we bring industry and expert leaders together to help discuss these types of issues. We do events. eRepublic has done the CUNY event for years, our IT conference, which is has an academic perspective to it as well as a technology perspective to it. And, you know, our leader here, Mike Zastrowski, was our first keynote speaker 20 years ago, in which we had, you know, good discussions about technology trending issues in education. But the most important thing is that in government and in education, we are a trusted third party, all right? We are an organization that doesn't do business with you. We don't want to do business with you. We don't want you to write us a check. We want you to trust what we say. We want to go out there and look at the industry. We want to go out there and give you real feedback on what's happening and allow you to use the information that we have to go back to your leadership and say, hey, look, this is what's happening out there. This is not from a source that's like a vendor who wants us to sort of, you know, write them a check or issue a purchase order. This is from a third party that has nothing to do with us. They're independent, but yet they have access and knowledge of the information that we can use in our organization. So over the next 24 months, one of my responsibilities is really to build out the education program, develop a better relationship and better connections to CIOs in education, and to build smaller groups of collaboration. Again, what I think this leadership board has been since its onset, and it really sets a model differently than what some of the other organizations are out there that support technology and education. You know, I'll use EDUCAUSE as an example. I've been to EDUCAUSE, right? And I've left EDUCAUSE with my head spinning because you've got to go there with a team of people just to sort of get value out of all the sessions and all the information that they're sharing. It's just a huge resource of information to sort of digest, but not everyone's voice is loud enough to go through it. We want to try to be collaborative. We want to build partnerships. But, you know, we understand you cannot build the same type of partnership with the vendor industry because of your own needs to sort of maintain a level of independence. But we have the ability to bring a leadership expertise from industry to sit down and have the good conversations with you, strategic conversations, not selling conversations, but strategic conversations. How do they see, you know, these types of projects that we're talking about or these challenges that we're talking about? How do they see what's happening in other industries or in the education industry? What kind of best practices have you seen or have they brought to the industry to sort of help support the challenges that you have or even the opportunities that you have available to you? So we view this as over the next couple of months, over the next 24 months, an opportunity to really build relationship, build credibility, build partnership, build awareness, support professional development of the current CIOs, but also think about what the next generation CIOs need to know. They're getting younger, but that also means that they're getting a lot less experience. How do we make sure that there's a good pipeline for you when you start doing what I did, which is figure out what you want to do next? Some of our strengths, you know, and Mike and I talked about this. We have an incredible engine and organization with an infrastructure behind it to do surveys. Now, I know that this was a very important part of what the board has done in the past. And I know with COVID, you know, we made some decisions to sort of step back from surveying. But we have enormous amount of data. And, you know, over the last day and a half, I've listened to, you know, questions that have come up that actually can be driven to sort of finding out what other institutions across the country are doing, but also what are some of the other industries other than education where there's so much similarity like government doing that is right for a survey. And maybe we can work with, you know, building out some surveys and ideas. We have the ability to sort of, you know, create content that is about great things that are going on in your institutions. We would be happy to sort of work with you if you'd like to highlight some great things that you're doing and be able to bring that to the front and center for your industry, your institution. We do events. We bring together small groups. I just got back from New Orleans where we had 28 of the CIOs across the country from the largest cities and counties, in which they spent a day and a half talking about issues like modernization versus innovation. We talked about identity management and single sign-on and where is it going and what trusted sources should government be thinking about for the identity access and identity management. We spent some time talking about the challenges associated with government workplace. Everything that we've talked about over yesterday around the challenges to hire within education, well, I heard it just a couple of days ago in government. There's a lot of overlap. But you know what? What came out of the conversation with the government CIOs was that they have to build more partnerships for a pipeline with universities. And, you know, how do they do that? How do they bring people together and how do they start those conversations? So there's definitely opportunity for partnership in that particular space. But it was a good day and a half worth of conversation about important topics that that we held at this event. We also do virtual events. On the government side, we've done, you know, some virtual events most recently with Chris Krebs from on dealing with cybersecurity. We do issues with women in government. I just finished doing a session for a virtual event on zero tolerance in education, or zero trust, I should say, in education, and the opportunity of using AI for data intelligence to inform zero trust principles and strategies. We've just did something with, you know, a discussion on K-12 regarding the future of a Chromebook. Is the Chromebook the right tool for K-12? Is it the right tool for K-5, K-6-8, 9-12? Is it the right tool for education? You know, what's out there? What's the opportunities? Why do it seem that the Chromebook has such a big footprint in education today? So, you know, these are what we've been doing. And then I reached out to Mike and I said, you know, what can we do potentially with the board to help be a better partner for you guys, knowing that over time, the relationship with the Chronicle, first, you know, it was optimistic. It did not necessarily evolve to where everyone thought it was going to go, but not necessarily where everyone wanted to go, right? And over time, we've decided to sort of scale back on the surveys and see where, you know, what, because there were so much other things going on. And the pandemic, quite frankly, had a huge impact on being able to sort of support all the workload that was going on in everyone's shop. So I gave some thought to this. And these slides here, and I'll share this full slide deck with everyone. I have no problem with that. But I gave some thought to, you know, where are there opportunities for eRepublic or Center for Digital Education to partner with this group of CIOs, and we can do virtual roundtables. If you guys have some really pressing topics and you want to be able to come together in a smaller setting, you want to bring some industry experts to the table to say, hey, we don't want you selling stuff. We want you to help educate us. We want to help you. We want you to inform us. We have the ability to reach out to that type of thought leadership and bring them to the table with those parameters and understandings in mind. Some of the ideas that I was thinking about over the course of the couple of weeks, as well as some of the things that was reinforced today, is what's the role and expectations of the CIO in education? You know, it's all changing. But you know what? It's also happening in government too. And we're not alone. Data privacy. What does it mean? Are you guys, I know at CUNY, we were struggling with data privacy. You know, I had a hard time trying to explain to my chancellor that we need a privacy officer for data and data governance. And, you know, his thinking was when he heard privacy, well, go talk to the risk management person or go talk to our general counsel. They'll run it. And the general counsel looked at me with like a deer in the headlights look and say, until I figure out what that is, come back to me in about 6 years. They didn't want to hear it. Cloud. How many times have we all heard cloud, right? You know, we're going to go to the cloud. We're going to use the cloud. We're going to do the cloud. Is the cloud safe? Is the cloud this? Is the cloud that? Did the cloud really turn out to be what we all hope it to be? I know we all have strategies for the cloud, right? But is the cloud the right answer? Or how do you guys begin to think about how you can shape the future of the cloud? And how loud do you need your voice to be to the industry leaders who are listening? I know when I was getting ready to leave CUNY, we were struggling with, you know, in-person learning versus hybrid learning versus high flex learning versus God knows what next learning. You know, what's the next best idea that's going to come out of the academic thinking and leadership and technologies? Is the technology from the industry ready to support all of these, you know, great ideas for high flex learning? I haven't found a solution that really, you know, is the silver bullet for high flex learning. And, you know, as you all know, sitting in a conference room with some people around the table and sitting in a conference room with some people on the screen, it's very hard to sort of, you know, make sure everyone's engaged. The same challenges exist in the classroom for our academic communities. You know, I wanted to talk about, you know, opportunities. Maybe we can do something on the education survey. Maybe we can renew it. Maybe we can go to some different version of the next version of the education surveys 2.0, looking at some really important issues like around infrastructure, use of the CARES money, ARPA money. How's the supply chain affecting the industry? And how's it affecting your ability to spend? Who's been creative in spending their ARPA money or their CARES money? It's time's running out. It is a ticking clock for everybody. So there are opportunities where we can think about surveys, and we have the infrastructure behind it to do it. I have the people who can write the survey questions. I have the people who can conduct the survey questions. I have the people who can analyze the data, and I have the people who can actually produce it in really valuable types of structures and formats that are useful to this organization when you need to go to your funding people, to your executive leadership. I mean, even if you need to sort of use it as a way of selling concepts and ideas to your communities that you work closely with. I also look at this is a really good thought leadership group to help guide me. You know, how can I be a better person to this organization? How can I shape the CDE's programs to better align to what the needs of the CIO are in education? Where is there an unmet need that other organizations or groups are not doing? I really want to be able to think about that. And I value your input and guidance as well. And then I think this is the last one, but how do we, you know, going forward, how can we potentially support you guys? How can we collaborate with this group on a more regular basis? I don't want you to feel like, you know, Brian's coming to these meetings because he's, you know, works for eRepublic. I'm coming to these meetings because I really am enjoying listening to the topics, but I also enjoy sharing what my experiences have been. I want to be a partner to you. I want to collaborate. I want to learn from you, and I also want to help you through your problems. So how can we do more with this group going forward? You know, and again, as I mentioned before, you know, we do a lot of publications. We have a great editorial team. They're always willing to help promote great things that are going on out there. They're also willing to, in some cases, you know, stoke a fire if there's, you know, something that's not going on out there and you guys have some good ideas, you know, let us know and we'll go out there and I'll get the editorial team to start researching it and saying, hey, maybe there is something here that we need to sort of be, you know, starting to raise up the fire, up the flagpole so that people start thinking about it in education because it has a real impact. So that's sort of what I'm doing now. If it sounds like I'm excited about it, I am. And if it, you know, I'm going to stop my share here. But it is a whole different role. It is Brian thinking about how to support an industry, through an organization that has resources and has relationships, really to sort of make to make your jobs, better, but to leverage the great work that Mike has done in bringing this group together on a regular basis. And we know how hard it is to sort of, you know, keep the group together and the commitment from everyone on this call and from yesterday, those who were able to be there yesterday, the commitment for you to spend a day and a half talking about these issues really, you know, is a true testament to the education philosophy of collaboration and also a demonstration of Mike's commitment to what LBCIO is and what the needs of a education CIO are. So that's my story.
Brian, it is an interesting time for you and an interesting time for us. We stopped doing the survey, as you pointed out, during the during COVID, and there were a lot of reasons for it. One is that we are finding that it's getting harder and harder to do surveys because there's so many of them going out, and there was every day it seemed like somebody else was doing requesting information for a survey. And the key that we have always tried to do that became very difficult for us the last few years is that we only surveyed chief information officers in higher ed. The problem that with the EDUCAUSE survey, which I started back in 89 and 90 when I was VP at CAUSE, is that when I was there, I used to do a review of the data and I would throw out data because I knew that that wasn't being brought forth from somebody who understood how to even respond to those questions. And so, you know, I'd compare data with other sources to make sure that the data was reflective of the institution. That isn't done. And in fact, I have had a number of our LBCIO members and other CIOs say that the EDUCAUSE survey does more harm than good today because some of the data that's posted there, it does not reflect what's going on in our business or industry. And there's a reason for it because you have anybody from a faculty member who fills out the survey to somebody who's a lower level manager in IT to somebody who's not even in IT filling out those surveys. And that makes it very difficult for people to use that data in a good way. And we've had trustees and executive leaders in higher ed have come back and said, hey, how come we're spending this much on IT when you look at the cost data or the EDUCAUSE data and it shows that we should be at this level? Well, that's not a real reflection and that can cause harm. And we've never wanted to do that. So we always, in the surveys we did the first 10 years here, we always surveyed only CIOs and we made sure that they were able to fill out those surveys, that they had the position and the information that they needed. And we also didn't ask questions that would be difficult for anybody to fill out. We didn't ask how many PCs are on campus. We don't care. That's difficult, if not impossible, to know anymore with respect to the technologies themselves. So we asked questions that were more dealing with strategy and where the institution was heading in the use of technology. And that was our claim to fame. But I will say that the last couple of years, many of those people that I've worked with personally over the last 30, 40 years, they're not in higher ed anymore. And their replacements don't fill out surveys in many cases. We had over 60% of our survey requests that never got to the CIOs. Even if I knew them, I would have people say, hey, are you going to send out a survey this year? And I would say, yeah, we sent it out. Never got it. It got spam filtered out. So that's a difficulty for us. And with us being small, it's just not worth it to do that anymore. I see the ability for us to direct some questions to your organization, Brian, and do some collaborative surveying that would give us insights that could be very useful for us. And that's originally what we wanted to do in the first place. So that is something that you pointed out that is there. We did a lot of webinars with the Chronicle of Higher Ed a few years ago, and not anymore. They're bringing in people that bring in money. So many of the webinars you see at the Chronicle level right now are webinars that have the majority of people are either the vendors themselves that are supporting it or their clients of that vendor. And so it's not really a look at an issue or a topic that has good objective insights from different people. It's trying to sell a product, to be very candid.
And Mike, and to that point, look, we do webinars in which we look for industry sponsorship because it helps to support the organization, and I won't lie to that. But we have a very firm policy about this. If it's a industry discussion with government or an industry discussion with education leaders, in most cases or in some cases, the vendors or the sponsors aren't even there. They're not in the webinar. They're not in the room, right? It's an open honors conversation. In other cases, we may invite them because they bring some expertise to the discussion, but it's with a very specific, line of understanding. This is an opportunity for you to educate. This is an opportunity for you to inform, but this is not an opportunity for you to sell. This is not a sales call. This is, these are people in government. We say these are the government people who need to know what they should be thinking about. These are the government people who need to know how they have to react. These are the government people who need to know how to plan. Your job is to help them think these three issues through. Let them decide when they're ready to buy something or what they want to buy. This is not the time nor the place.
Brian, I have an idea. I was doing this for a while, but bringing in like CEOs of companies to talk with us, to talk about that they're interested in. And a lot of times I had John Chambers talk to my group when I was at Stanford about leadership and Michael Dell talk about optimization. And that drew big crowds of people and it allowed us to talk to somebody of CIOs and some of my leadership staff, but it allowed us to have conversations, very deep ones with someone who was thinking about this as far as their company. And also getting feedback. I was on Steve Jobs' CIO advisory council. He'd bring us together four times a year and they would throw out these big ideas of what Apple wanted to do. And he would just listen and provide feedback back, just the thoughts about it. And that would tie us back to some of these companies at a very high level. I wouldn't mind having the CEOs of companies that I want to work with on my contact list and also provide value to them. And I think your company could facilitate that. And I know I'd be interested and I think I would limit the amount of people that are going to show up and that you have to be prepared for the meeting and ready to engage and not just going there as some people would say, a passenger, but a person pedaling.
Yep. I like the idea, Mitch, and I certainly can go back and we can talk about how we bring in some of those thought leader CEOs. And I had a similar conversation with Michael Dell years ago where I asked Michael an interesting question. do you want me as an industry, as a university, to train people in technology so that you can hire them? Or do you want to train them as a technologist when you get there? And he said, it's a great question. He says, I'd rather you not train them in technology. I'd rather you give them the skills that I can't give them. Teach them how to speak, how to write, how to think analytically, how to do what you as universities need to do to train people. And then when they come to my organization, I'll teach them all about the other technologies. So it was an interesting thought that Michael had years ago, right? I'm not sure
That's actually the basis for a master's degree we're creating with Juniper and Salesforce with Tuff.
Yep, but that was the thinking. And Mike, going back to your point about the survey, the beautiful part about this, and I think, you know, where we can partner in surveying is that, you know, it's great to survey yourselves. And basically it's sort of like, you know, you already know what the answers are going to be because you're already talking about what your environments look like and the challenges you're operating on. But again, as our reach is greater and we have a K through 12 reach as well, as we grow our reach beyond sort of this group, we have the ability to sort of bring back not only what this group already knows, but how does this group benchmark compared to its other CIOs in education? We also have the ability to ask the K through 12 industry questions that you're dying to know. You know, there is such a convergence between K through 12 and higher ed today, more than ever before, but it's not happening in high school anymore. It's happening even sooner. Right. And, you know, what do you need to know as CIOs to prepare for those students who are eventually going to be coming to your institutions a lot sooner than ever before? And then you're becoming a much more, you know, as a university or as a institution, you're now becoming a lot more ingrained in community with adult and continuing education, workforce development, all those other things that are going on. You know, how do we connect you with that part of the world and survey what government wants to know? You know, what does government want from us as an institution, as a higher education? How can we be a better partner to government? There's also a lot of overlap. And I, you know, one of the beautiful things that I was able to bring to this organization is to explain to them, hey, you know, that CISO at, you know, jurisdiction XYZ, they have the same challenges as the CISO does at institution XYZ. It's the same problems. All right. Matter of fact, in some cases, even bigger magnitude because you're under more attack sometimes than governments are under attack. And you have to be much more open in your environments because of the nature of academics. Whereas government can, you know, easily say, no, we're closed. We don't let anything out into the cloud. We lock everything down. But the challenges are out there. I think there's tremendous overlap in some of the issues that you're fighting with. Migration to the cloud for your ERP systems. It's a big, big, huge thing right now for government. You know, they're going from, you know, legacy on-prem systems to SaaS, you know, as a service. They go into infrastructure as a service. They're looking at, you know, identity management now. Do they need to start thinking more about, you know, identity management as a service and get away from the on-prem stuff? They're looking at they're engaged in these bigger conversations about passwordless environments and biometrics because of breaches and security access issues, as well as the biggest challenge for governments is, you know, trust. You know, citizens don't naturally trust government for identity management, identity access. I don't want to give you my information. I don't trust you. You know, how do they build that trust? So there's a lot of community engagement as well. So lots of things going on that in some cases you've already done by building relationships with students and faculty that government hasn't even learned how to do yet.
Well, when we originally began the leadership board, the key was we would create an organization, never got over 50 people, so that we could have personal relationships and we could share, let our hair down and say what we wanted to in the room. And it's kind of like what goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas. What goes on in LBCAO stays within our group. And we've done that pretty well. And so that when we do personal surveys, we do this regularly where somebody will say, hey, has anybody done this? And can you tell me what you think of this particular package or vendor? And what should we be aware of so that we don't make a mistake? That kind of stuff we've been doing since the beginning. Vendors, we've been very reluctant. We've had vendors that wanted to get involved in our meetings. And the only time I can really think of, and Doyle, you probably remember that, we had the meeting in Denver, and Datatel had just acquired SCTs. And so there was the merging of the two largest as far as numbers of institutions, suppliers of higher ed administrative applications. John Speer said, I will come speak to your group. And we had maybe 20 people there. And he said, but no cameras, no, this is off the record kind of thing. And you can ask me anything you want. And we did. And it was a very collaborative, creative session where we got to share our concerns and our insights about that part of our industry, administrative applications and ERP. And it went very well. I can see that kind of thing happening that Mitch talked about with people looking for thought leadership, that we would get involved. But I have to say, I think we're going to need to think about how best to work a relationship with you, Brian, and with you, you know, the Center for Digital Education, so that we can look at how best to keep what's part of our culture. And maybe it should change. Maybe it shouldn't. We need to look beyond what we've done in the past and look what we ought to be doing for the future. And I think you provide us with some opportunities to do that. Certainly the Chronicle right now, I'm not sure where they're going to end up in the next few years. They were moving in one direction, knowing that paper was going to go away. And so the people we worked with to start the leadership board, they knew that they were going to have to provide thought leadership outside of the traditional newspaper venue. What happened was it's privately owned. And when Corbin came back to run it after being out of the running of the organization for 10 or 15 years, decides that we're going to have to invest more in paper, that we need to go back to our original business. And those people, the rest of them left. And it's been a very difficult environment to work with. The people that we have left at the Chronicle, many of them know that they've got to change the way they're doing business, but they haven't had the freedom to do that. So I think you provide us with opportunity just to do things like the webinars or roundtable discussions, those kinds of things we could do together and having a vendor.
What might be really interesting, though, because the view Brian brings, especially when he looks at K-12 and looks at government, and then broadly as he's looking at it, is if we had one meeting that was kind of dedicated to two things. One is, what's not going to change in higher education? And say, these are going to be things that we absolutely know won't change in higher education, that we have to focus on and get better at. But also, what are things that absolutely probably will change in higher education, and let's get rid of thinking we have to make them better, and let's plan on getting rid of these things and understand how are they going to change. And let him bring his expertise on helping us divide those two buckets.
It's a great thought idea, Doyle. And we can certainly bring some higher education expertise. We have senior fellows who are in the K-12 as well as in the higher education space who come out of this industry, who can help do some thought leadership on these topics. We can certainly talk to we can bring some industry in who are involved in education and say, where do they see it going? That's, you know, we know that it's going to be this way, you know, that's it, you know. And we know we have to, we want to listen to you, but we also want to tell you, what do we see as the roadmap in the changes that are going to occur from a technology perspective, so that you guys have I hate to use the word crystal ball, but in some cases, I think you want a crystal ball. You know, that's the hardest part for you guys is, you know, trying to sort of keep up with change.
Well, I think that's wrong in the sense that a lot of people here are driving that change.
No.
Not looking to you for the crystal ball, but offering you one to look at.
Well, and Mitch, I don't mean to imply that you're not driving change. I think you are, right? It's you're driving change by adapting or adopting the technologies that are evolving, right? And you're building them into your organization. So the question is, what's the crystal ball for what the industry is developing for the future? And how is that going to impact all the planning and all the good work that you're doing today?
Well, I think going back to the original sort of conversation in yesterday, is it's not about technology, it's about people.
No.
Mm-hmm. And what are the organization, what is education going to become? And what are we doing to basically act as an accelerator to that mission? And the role of the CIO in that acceleration around the business and not the technology. The technology is a piece that we come to the table with and why we're invited. The stuff that we really do that makes a difference is how you change the organization to basically position itself ahead of everyone else. When a competitive, in a competitive environment, far as I'm concerned, I'm always in a competitive environment. And I'm always looking for ways to optimize and accelerate the business I'm in, whether it's in higher ed or the consultants that I work with. For me, it's not the technology. You telling me about the technology, I can read about that. I can engage with that. I can read all the sort of industry laser world and see what's coming in the next 5 to 10 years to get a perspective on what we might be able to create. What's really interesting, if you can basically sit down with people who are trying to determine what technologies are they going to create that are actually going to meet our business need, that's going to be there, right? That they know, they can see in the future that this is the business need within this organization, the type of things we're going to do. Let's create a technology that actually is there waiting for them when they can get there. And I think that that's more interesting to me. I want something that's going to stump me. I want something that's going to twist me up. I want something to disrupt my present form of thought about where I'm going, what I'm doing. And that's what helps me. Sometimes I hear it here. Sometimes I hear it in other places. So if your organization is that disruption, that ability to basically open up your mind a little bit and think alternatively towards the way you're going, then I'm really interested. If it's another survey or another thing like, or something that about an existing space that exists today, I could care less about that because that isn't really going to drive me forward other than give me some different way of approaching a problem.
Brian, I think that there's opportunities for us to collaborate and do things together. It's going to take us a bit to kind of think through it because we've been kind of functioning in one direction and then we switched a little bit because of the pandemic. And we're looking at hopefully being able to come together face to face. I mean, part of what we've missed in the virtual spring and fall meetings the last 2 years is that our face to face, how much of what we really accomplish gets done as a leadership board over coffee or a drink or meal. We haven't been able to do that. We can see each other as we are right now on a screen, but it's still not the same as the conversations we had when we get together face to face and literally on a campus. One of the changes when the Chronicle first came to us, we did our sessions at a hotel and the cost was greater for everybody. And so we said, let's stop that. So when they said, would you take it completely over? And I said, yes. We're going to meet on campus. We're going to cut the dues in half because we don't need that overhead of paying for a hotel space and the rest. And part of our learning is literally being on somebody's campus and seeing things as they exist, because you can talk about them all you want. But the reality is that many times what gets talked about at EDUCOST never happens on campus. It's an idea that never took place. And I've watched that through the years. When I first took the VP role at COS, I went to several campuses and I was looking at things that were presentations that were done at our conference, our annual conference, and they were in Cause Effect, our publication. And I found many times those things were an idea, but they never became a part of the institution. And so we get to cut through that by being face to face with one another and getting on our campuses. And
I'm sorry, again, Mike.
That's just to me a key part of why we exist, I think, as a leadership board.
Yeah, I agree with you on the whole face to face thing. We're seeing that there's a lot of value to sort of getting back in person. And that face to face is nothing, there's nothing more valuable than those, you know, side conversations that can occur spontaneously. That can occur at the coffee station or something like that. There's huge value to that. And, you know, we would be very happy to sort of, you know, try to see if there's ways that we can help support, you know, enabling those types of face-to-face conversations as well. You know, we have lots of state events that are going on now, that are in person that don't have an education, track at all. Maybe we can help, you know, think about future education tracks to incorporate more face-to-face for people there. You know, maybe we can do some, you know, we can help you and help support the board in the context of your own events being in person and, you know, helping you support the conversations that occur, and bring more value or more thought to you, you know, as a partner.
One of the things I was going to say that just hit me really well with what you're able to do is that we have been talking over the last 2 days quite a bit about our IT organization and hiring and retaining people that are key and having a hybrid workforce that people that can work away. When you stop and think about that, many of our employees today in IT that can work anywhere in the world and live wherever they want to, they can join our organizations. How does that change our salary structure? Because now all of a sudden, I'm not competing for my local region for employment, which may be low or may be high. I'm competing for talent that's more global or certainly national. And that's a different structure than having salaries that we compare for this or that particular, let's say a CISO or whatever, from one industry or from one region. So I think there's things like that where you can really help us in some of the stuff you do. We could have great dialogue and research, collaborative research together on.
Yeah. That's a great idea, Mike. You know, we have a couple of things that are already in the pipeline and we have some things that we're working on. So the things that are in the pipeline right now that we have active groups working on in government, that we have actually a cybersecurity council that's looking at various different issues on cybersecurity. I know we're all probably, you know, thought leadership and, you know, webinared out on cybersecurity, but, you know, we just can't escape it. But the things that we've been talking about are things like cyber insurance and what do you need to do? What's your best practices? What's a methodology that you need to follow to evaluate your organizational risk structure so that you can even become eligible for thinking about cyber insurance. So we have an advisory group that's working on that. We have an advisory group that's working on digital privacy, coming up with best practices from an organizational perspective to address digital privacy issues, policy issues, things like that. The borderless hiring came up in our government meeting recently, and we're going to be putting together a group of CIOs from governments to talk about borderless hiring and how they do it. How do they get around some of the government challenges associated with this and the international hiring challenges associated with it to be able to support borderless hiring. So we certainly love to include an education representation on any of those, the Great. Cybersecurity Council, the Digital Privacy Council. We actually have a group of people now from governments across the country who are coming together to do update. We published a best practices guide on doing as a service procurements for cybersecurity. And we're doing an update now. It's actually become a template that's been used by governments around the country since 2016. And now we're updating it so that we can republish it for the use of by governments and even education for the purposes of buying as a service types of terms and conditions that you need to be thinking about including in your RFPs and your procurements. And we would welcome sharing that with this group so that they get the best of our knowledge and the best of the work that's going on out there. So I think there is good opportunity for that too.
Brian, you know our organization, you've been part of it. So I would offer that maybe bring us some examples right away of things that we could get involved with that might be helpful to you. And then we'll, as a board, start to think about how best to use that relationship in the future. So, you know, I think what we need to do is learn more. How many of you in here on our board knew much about eRepublic and the Center for Digital Education? Any of you had much contact or involvement?
I subscribed to several of the magazines you saw, but candidly, I didn't really pay a lot of attention to them. I would, you know, periodically an article would come up and I would look at it and whatnot. After your presentation, I'm going to pay more attention to it. I mean that seriously. Okay. But I'm still subscribing. It's sort of one of those things that just like a lot of other e-magazines.
It's hard to keep up.
Yeah.
Yep. It's definitely hard to keep up. And which is why I think there's an opportunity where we can really structure it around more thoughtful ideas that really impact you so that it would be something that you want to read or you would get value out of. Very similar to what Mitch said before. Mike, I like the idea. I will put together some ideas where we can partner. I'll shoot it out to you. You can share it with the leadership board directly. And you know, the other thing is that there are things that we do, that we host events that are coming up that if you want, I can send out the invitation to you, Mike, and then you can share with the leadership board and say, hey, the Center for Digital Education is hosting a webinar on this. If you're interested, mm-hmm. please feel free That's to cool. join. You know, here's our best practices guide on procurements. You can share it with them, but I'll start sending you things that I believe that are of, that could demonstrate value to this group. And also I think can be thought provocative for the group to say, hey, you know, we like this idea. Maybe we can do something that's more education based.
Thank you very much, Brian. And thank you all for the meetings have been just fun the last couple of days. I apologize for the Zoom problem today. I had no idea until Mitch said, hey, I'm logged in, but it says I need permission. And I apologize for that. I don't know what happened on that. But anyway, thank you all for joining. Any final thoughts on anything related to the last couple of days and what we do next? Anybody? We're looking at fall meeting and we have several institutions that have volunteered. Tina has offered the University of Mount Union in Ohio and so has John Rothschi from Kent State. Depending on the dates that we select, one or the other, those would be areas that we might literally meet on campus. And that's not a bad place to meet in Ohio because it's close driving distance wise for a lot of institutions in our membership group. So those are thoughts. Let us know more about that and we'll be together in May.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I do have a thought on what we should do next.
Sure.
We should get a drink because we're going to need it.
See, we miss that too, don't we?
Yeah.
Vince, I think you relocated.
Yeah, this is my backyard. So. Sorry, I just got to do it every time.
Just rub it in, Vince. Well, thank you all. And I have to say, for me, it's been very, how do I say this? It's just good for me to realize that after spending 10 days in the hospital, that I am still able to get together with friends and colleagues and discuss stuff that's just fun. And I hope, Brian, in your new environment, that you will find that what you're doing is fun and enjoyable for you. I wish you the best in that because that's what you should be doing. That's what we all should be doing, really.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you to everyone here for sort of listening to me and indulging and the good ideas. My goal here is to sort of continue this relationship, which has been long and established. And, you know, seeing what more I can do to help you, because that's been, when I go back to what I wanted to do when I grow up, is I still wanted to continue to add value to these discussions in a different way.
Well, thank you all. And we'll be putting out our next meeting for May and topics and thoughts that you have that we need to discuss. Tej, I have several people that want to know about how you're doing with respect to your administrative application suite and where you are in that too. So if maybe you and Michael can, you and Mike can share some of that at some point, we'd sure like to hear more.
Absolutely, Mike.
Thank you all. And hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks all. Thanks, Thank Mike, you. For doing what you're doing.
Thanks, everyone.
Goodbye.
Good Bye. To see you, even if it is virtual.
Have a great weekend.